Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. If you enjoy our podcasts, please tell your colleagues and subscribe on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy! Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host again today, Ian Lewins, one of the paediatric emergency medicine consultants in Derby. And I'm really pleased to be joined today by Dr. Claire Chandler, who's a paediatric registrar based in Alice Springs. Hi, Claire, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Ian.
Good. We were just sort of briefly discussing the differences in our weather. So I'm sat here in Derby. It's raining out the window and it's 5 degrees and it's slightly different where you are, I take it.
About 40 degrees, I reckon, at the moment, and the sun is bearing down.
So I don't know who's got the better deal. Probably you, but I don't look great in shorts, so I think I'll stick with my 5 degrees and rain. So we chatted when we met at the DFTB19 conference, and I know that you're keen to talk about rheumatic fever, which is something I think I've seen maybe once in about 20 years. So for those of us who've not seen it or are very, very unfamiliar, what is rheumatic fever?
So essentially, acute rheumatic fever is an immunological reaction to a group A strep infection, which causes a generalized inflammatory response in various parts of the body, with the most significant sequelae of it being rheumatic heart disease.
And this is sort of one of the things that you learn for exams, isn't it? The major and the minor criteria
exactly.
For those sorts of things. I can never, ever remember them, and I'll be really impressed if you can.
So I think breaking it down, particularly the major criteria, it's quite easy to think of it as heart, brain, joints, skin. So when we're talking major criteria with the heart, that's rheumatic carditis, and essentially it can affect any part of the heart. So you could have it affecting the pericardium, epicardium, myocardium, or most commonly the endocardium, so a valvulitis. So that's the heart component of the major criteria. Joint-wise, we're talking about arthritis, so primarily migratory polyarthritis involving mostly the larger joints. Brain, think of Sydenham chorea, so this abrupt non-rhythmic movements. Then skin, we've got the less commonly seen major criteria of erythema marginatum and the subcutaneous nodules. Then breaking it down, we've got our minor manifestations, which are the arthralgia, a significant fever, elevated inflammatory markers such as ESR and CRP, and prolonged PR on ECG.
And you've got to, my recollection is you need two major or one major and two minor. Is that?
Yes. But depending on your population, so we'd be using the 2015 modified Jones criteria, but it can be slightly adapted depending on if you're working with a high risk population or not.
Okay, which we'll come on to in a second.
Yeah.
But just to be clear, this is not. So you said this is sort of often following strep infection of the throat,
yeah,
but this is not because of the strep, it's the body's reaction to the strep.
Correct. And so I think this is the strep infection in the throat is where we actually differ a little bit here in Central Australia. So we actually see primarily the acute rheumatic fever that's actually associated with streptococcal skin infections. We have an incredibly high burden of skin disease here with our Indigenous peoples, often living in very overcrowded houses with I mean, there's some facts going around that an Indigenous kid each year or within the first year of life would get 11 skin infections. So we're actually seeing it more being following skin infections rather than the pharyngitis.
Right. Okay. Well, that's interesting. That's very, very different, you know, from sort of my perspective where I work, it's there's a lot of discussion about strep and or sore throats and you know, who doesn't need antibiotics. And the vast, vast majority of the children that we're seeing really, really don't need the antibiotics. But that's really interesting. It's still a totally different type of strep infection that you're seeing.
Yes, exactly. And so pretty much any Indigenous child that comes into contact with healthcare here, whether they have a sore throat, a clinically obvious pharyngitis, or any sort of infected skin lesions, they'll get some long-acting bicillin injected straight away. We're very, very liberal with it here just because of these non-separative complications.
Right. So having said, you know, I might have seen one or two in about 20 years. How frequently are you seeing that?
I've seen two this week.
Right.
Yeah. So to give you an idea, when you check up to date, it will say that rheumatic heart disease and acute rheumatic fever isn't seen in the developed world. I think the global burden is about 33 million people worldwide. Here in the NT, it's quite, we've got at some of, I believe, the highest rates. So I've got a couple of figures for you. When you're looking at between 2005 and 2019, 98% of the cases of rheumatic heart disease were firstly seen in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Overall, they were 69 times more likely than non-Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to actually develop rheumatic fever, 64 times more likely to have rheumatic heart disease. And then, sadly, in the 3 years where they measured between 2007 and 2009, we had over 897 deaths that were directly attributable to rheumatic heart disease. So we have a very significant burden here in our population.
Wow.
And it's truly a significant cause of premature mortality and really sad in a disease that is so easily preventable.
Okay. So for those patients that you're sort of seeing where you're suspecting that they've got acute rheumatic fever, how do you manage them? What do you do?
Okay. So a child comes to the department. I think the most common presentation we will see is that they're non-weight bearing, that they've got a sore joint, usually a knee, a hip, an ankle. So we'll work them up. We'll be doing we need to check for fever as one of the minor criteria. We'd be doing an ECG to check their PR interval and comparing it to the age appropriate PR interval. Bloods, an ESR, a CRP. We'll be doing streptococcal serology, an ASOT, checking if they have pharyngitis. We'll do a throat swab culture. If they've got any boils, any sort of active skin lesions, swabbing those as well. Treatment-wise, they'll get the LA or long-acting bicillin, which will cover them for the active streptococcal infection. Then I guess it's just about pain and symptom management. So one of the almost diagnostic features of a rheumatic joint is its response to NSAIDs. So what you will see is a remarkable recovery in this joint pain just after a couple of doses of ibuprofen and another appropriate NSAID. So our kids who come with significant joint disease will be getting regular NSAIDs on the ward, obviously watching their kidney function, because we do have genetically predisposition in the Indigenous population and multiple other factors that mean we have to be quite careful with ibuprofen.
Okay.
Yeah, and then so that's treatment-wise. If they've got a prolonged PR interval, we'll be monitoring that at regular intervals. They'll often be having bed rest while they await an echocardiogram for further assessment for carditis. That pretty much covers it. If they've got Sydenham's chorea, there's some other treatments, but they're quite specific.
Yeah. And how soon is it most sort of useful to do the echo? Do you do it sort of straight away or do you
yeah.
do
serial? Yeah, we do the echo really as soon as we can get it when we've got suspected when we've got the diagnosis of ARF here, so yeah. acute rheumatic fever.
And in terms of sort of discharge from hospital, mm-hmm. what things are you looking for to say actually you're safe to go home?
Yeah, so generally we want to see resolution of the joint pain. We want to see that their PR interval is downtrending if it was elevated, that they've had the echocardiogram, because so many of our kids are very difficult to get back into the hospital when they live hundreds to thousands of kilometres away. So we want to get that echo done. And then we want to have all the planning around them to ensure that if they are a probable or suspected or a confirmed case of rheumatic heart disease, that they have the supports around them to get the ongoing penicillin therapy they need.
Yeah, and I mean, in terms of follow-up, you mentioned the huge distances that. Do you arrange follow-up? Do you attempt to follow up? And if
yes,
so, people can come back.
Yes, so we have a fantastic rheumatic heart disease register here in the Northern Territory and in a few other states around Australia, which really helps out with that. We've got an enthusiastic and dedicated rheumatic heart disease nurse. Who assists with all the coordination. We have visiting cardiologists and then, of course, the health professionals out in the remote clinics who are very aware of the disease and understand exactly what needs to be done to help the kids get their labicillin injections 3 to 4 weekly and get them back in for appropriate reviews.
If you were seeing sort of a child, a similar sort of child, but mm-hmm. from kind of a traditional, typical Western background, mm-hmm. would you treat them similarly, or is it a very different sort of approach given the sort of prevalence of the diseases in the two communities?
Well, we see it a lot less in the non-Indigenous population. I think in the 3 years that I've been in Alice Springs, I've seen one or two. I think the major difference is just the contact that they have with the healthcare system. So often this will be someone who's living in town who can come in for frequent checkups. And so I think that really the difference in treatment is only that they're more advantaged when it comes to connection with our health service. There's also the question of whether or not the children go on IM prophylaxis versus oral. But even for someone who is in town and has access to the medicines, it is more reliable, I believe, to just give the IM penicillin, because you just get such better compliance.
Sure. But I guess given the sort of the severity of this illness and mm-hmm. As you said, sort of very, very major and significant sequelae.
Yeah.
If you sort of saw an Indigenous child with a sore throat, would you have a very, very low threshold to give them just penicillin anyway?
100%. Yeah. We just give it straight away. Even if it's likely viral, we would err on the side of giving labicillin. Yeah.
And I remember reading a blog by Casey Parker sort of talking about differences in approach to sore throats in Indigenous and non-Indigenous populations, and just the balance of benefit against risk is so swung the other way for the two populations.
Yeah.
Are there other sort of, in your time that you've spent in Alice Springs, are there other sort of significant differences you've seen between the two communities or the indigenous communities in terms of healthcare and diseases, if you like?
Yeah, so I think what I was talking about earlier in terms of particularly those who are living out in remote communities, their housing situation is really quite poor. We have, you know, multiple, sometimes 20 family members living in the same house. You can imagine in wintertime here it gets into the negatives. Their showers might not be adequately set up with hot water. So it's really, really hard for them to maintain, you know, adequate hygiene levels which means that their skin is often in poorer conditions. I mentioned scabies. We get a lot of tinea, and these sort of chronic skin infections just really open them up the passage for them to get abscesses and then for diseases like rheumatic heart disease. I mentioned kidney disease as well. We're also seeing a rather alarming amount of young people with insulin resistance and diabetes. We've, you know, got 10-year-olds with HbA1c's around 15, which is really quite alarming. Mm.
And you mentioned you said you worked sort of there for 3 years.
Now. Yes.
Had you always lived in the Northern Territories?
Yeah. I'm a rare species, a born and bred Northern Territorian. So I did medical school up in the Top End, and yeah, I've done all my medical training down in Alice. Yeah.
So for those people who've kind of not worked there, not worked with those communities, is it something that you would recommend? Is it, or you know, do you wish you worked elsewhere? Or
I recommend that everyone comes through Central Australia at some point in their career. It's an amazing opportunity to work with some beautiful people with ancient cultures. It's a place where you can be challenged personally, professionally, that you can learn so much. And it's a really, I think the healthcare here has, particularly in Alice Springs Hospital, we've got some great leadership. We have some truly dedicated clinicians with vast knowledge. It's just, I recommend it. I wouldn't, if I didn't have to leave to pursue further pediatric training, I'd stay here longer. It's great.
Right. I guess that was going to come on to my next question is, what's your longer term plan then?
Yeah. So, I mean, in the future, I'd really like to come back to Alice. It's, you know, I think we harp on about working towards closing the gap in Indigenous and non-Indigenous life expectancy in Australia. And I see working in rural and remote Australia really the place where that can happen. We need physicians here who are willing to stay, to learn, make a difference through longevity. And that's what I'd like to do in the future.
Yeah. But you mentioned that you'll need to leave.
Yeah, unfortunately. So I've done a year of unaccredited regging here, and unfortunately it can't get accredited. So I have to step out into the big smoke and away from this 40-degree heat and, check out what it's like in the big cities for a while.
Right. Well, if you ever want, say, 5-degree temperatures and miserable rain, then you're very, very welcome in the East Midlands in the UK. And at least we've only got one time zone in this country. I'm still really struggling to get my head around the other time zones.
Thanks, Ian. I might actually have to pick you up on that offer after several summers here. 5 degrees will be a nice change.
Lovely. Claire, that's been absolutely fascinating for me. It's something, you know, we just don't see. But something that's so common for you, so that's really helpful educationally for me, and I hope for our listeners as well. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. Remember, you can subscribe to our feed on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you for listening.